This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russian investigator says the Pentagon and some companies have spent millions of dollars on developing Ukraine's bioweapons program. Iran says diplomacy will continue to reach a final agreement on reviving the 2015 deal, adding Washington is expected to adopt a realistic approach. And South Korea says the neighboring North has fired an unidentified projectile off of its east coast. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. A top Russian investigator says the United States has been involved in Ukraine's bioweapons development program. Alexandra Bastrykin says the analysis obtained by documents show representatives from the Pentagon and certain American firms have been involved in biological military activities in Ukraine. The Russian investigator says Washington has spent over $224 million since 2005 on such programs. He says the sum has been funneled into about 30 research centers run by Ukraine's defense, health, and agricultural ministries. Russia has long accused Ukraine of pursuing U.S.-funded bioweapons, that amid Washington's allegations that Moscow could launch a chemical attack on its western neighbor, a claim that the Kremlin vehemently denies. Ukraine is turning into an arena for a proxy war between nuclear superpowers, the United States and Russia. The Pentagon has recently said that it is providing Ukrainian armed forces with training on key systems at the U.S. military installations in Germany. Now fears have grown that the war could spill to other countries in Europe.
The Pentagon says it's training Ukrainian troops in Germany and other locations in Europe, an announcement that's likely to anger Russia. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Germany is one of the roughly three locations where over 100 Ukrainian troops are being trained on operating howitzer artillery systems and radars. The troops are set to go back to Ukraine and provide a training to others on how to operate the systems that the United States has recently pledged to the country. Kirby also says the United States is considering training Ukrainian troops on how to use other equipment in a virtual format. The White House has recently called on Congress to provide $33 billion in additional assistance to Ukraine, some two-thirds of which earmarked for military purposes. Washington has already sent millions of dollars worth of weapons and equipment to Ukraine. That's on top of the aid packages other NATO allies have allocated to Kiev.
At a war between these two great superpowers, the U.S. and Russia, would be absolutely disastrous for the entire world with the threat of nuclear war. But in practicality, absolutely, it does mean that. It does mean that just as we have in Syria, where the U.S. will train extremist fighters, the U.S. is functionally at war with the Syrian government and the Syrian people, though perhaps not literally on paper. I think the same thing applies to Ukraine. If the U.S. is going to fund and now actively train people to fight against Russia's special operation in Ukraine, then the U.S. is functionally at war.
Russia has earlier warned that weapons poured into Ukraine from the West will be fair game for its strikes. The United States and other NATO member states had initially said they didn't want to enter into a direct conflict with Russia. Is that the reason why they're helping prolong the war in Ukraine, which in effect is likely to turn into a proxy conflict?
West assistance to Ukraine is not limited to military hardware. A recent congressional push to give U.S. President Joe Biden the authority to declare war with Russia has sparked fresh concerns about the possibility of a wider conflict. Washington's intelligence cooperation with Kiev is raising tensions about Moscow as well.
On May 1st, Adam Kinzinger, a Republican congressman representing Illinois' 16th congressional district, introduced a resolution dubbed Authorization for Use of Military Force to Defend America's Allies, or AUMF. If passed, the resolution would enable U.S. President Joe Biden to use his war powers against Russia in case Moscow carries out a chemical or nuclear strike in Ukraine. But, in the event of a war, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. That could explain why both have ruled out the possibility of a direct confrontation. It can also be the reason why the West has resorted to imposing sanctions on Russia and providing Ukraine with assistance. One such example is the spy satellites belonging to the U.S. military and private firms that are gathering intel on Russian military positions and movements in Ukraine and relaying them to the U.S. and its allies, including Kiev itself.
I mean, if there's anything that we learned from the 90s, it's that when NATO gets involved in a war, it is disastrous for the civilians more than anyone else. We saw that in Yugoslavia. And unfortunately, it looks like we may see that again in Ukraine. And if NATO were to become involved, if NATO were to declare war on Russia or even amp up its support for Ukraine, be it money, weaponry, training, whatever it may be, it will be disastrous. And it will make this conflict become more prolonged, which is, I'm sure, what Lockheed Martin and Boeing and the other big corporations in the U.S. military industrial complex want.
These developments are pushing the tensions to the point of no return. What's certain is that a possible war between superpowers won't have a winning side.
Iran says it will continue on the path of diplomacy to achieve a final agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal, also known as the JCPOA. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with his Irish counterpart, Simon Coveney. Iran's top diplomat said it is now the turn for the U.S. to adopt a realistic stance. He said Washington must make up for the illegal approach of former President Donald Trump and come up with a potential initiative. The Irish foreign minister, for his part, praised Iran's initiative and highlighted the importance of an agreement that would satisfy the demands of all sides. Amir Abdullahian had said earlier in the day that the talks in Vienna were not stopped but continue in a different format. Iran demands a complete removal of sanctions and guarantees that the U.S. will not quit the deal again. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over alleged human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Khalq organization back in the 1980s. Videos on social media show MKO members harassing Nouri's family as they enter a court building. The footage shows that Swedish police failed to protect the family. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as a political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then-president and prime minister. Robert Carter was outside Stockholm court where a group of MKO supporters were demonstrating. There he spoke to an eyewitness who had seen Hamid Nouri's family being harassed by the members of the terrorist group. Let's take a listen.
Fantastic. So you're living here in Sweden, an Iranian national, and just tell me, obviously you're not involved in what's going on here at the court, but as an eyewitness you've seen what the group to my right has been up to over the past couple of days, in specific harassment of the family of the accused who have been coming here on a daily basis to witness the proceedings and take part in the court case. Just tell us a little bit about what you've seen.
First of all, I'm really happy that I could find you to open my heart, actually, regarding to what's happening here. These people are known in all Iran history for past 42 years. And unfortunately, those, I don't like to call them people, but those standing there, those people standing there are the most hated group in Iran. They are a terrorist organization. They have been terroring, killing, torturing, bombing, and doing many crimes against Iranian civilians.
I think I wanted to ask you one more time exactly what you saw when you saw the harassment taking place. I think if you could describe that in a bit more detail. You saw them harassing the family of Nouri, is that right?
Yeah, the first time actually when I said it, there was a screaming. I was passing here to go to my job. I hear just in Persian language, it's a bunch of people screaming and saying really, really shameful and bad words toward the old woman, which I never have seen it in all my life. It didn't never exist in my world. So I was just shocked by what I'm hearing for what? Against a woman walking up to the stairs? All kind of those words? No point.
North Korea has reportedly test-launched yet another missile amid worries on the Korean Peninsula over its nuclear program. The South Korean military has been quoted by the media saying that an unidentified projectile was fired towards the sea off the northeast coast. No further detail has been available. The North Korean leader recently vowed to accelerate the development of his country's nuclear arsenal, calling it a symbol of national power. Kim Jong-un also said that the North would not shy away from the preemptive use of nuclear weapons to counter hostile forces. Thus alone, North Korea has fired multiple short-range and long-range ballistic missiles. The country has doubled down on Kim's military modernization drive as well as missile tests while ignoring the offers of talks from the U.S. Our correspondent Jennifer Chang is with us. Jennifer, give us more updates regarding that.
Well, right now, details are not immediately known. This is still a breaking news story. So it's unknown whether this is an ICBM, the highly anticipated intercontinental ballistic missile test, showing that North Korea can fire a nuclear warhead at any point in the U.S., along with decoys and multiple warheads. But that is what experts are expecting. We have to see what kind of missile this is, and those results of the investigation will come out later. However, just last week, the North paraded its Hwasong-17 monster ICBM, which the U.S. missile defenses are helpless to stop. This missile can hit any point in the U.S. with a nuclear warhead. And so this is going to be what the focal point will be. The North had fired a missile, an ICBM missile, which it said was the Hwasong-17 last month, but the U.S. and South Korea claimed that this was not the Hwasong-17, but the Hwasong-15, an earlier version. And Pyongyang is eager to show that it is indeed firing off the Hwasong-17. Now, the Hwasong-17 is different from the Hwasong-15 because it has multiple warheads and decoys that can evade any U.S. missile defense systems. So we will see whether this is the Hwasong-17, but experts say it's no problem for the North to conduct a successful Hwasong-17 test. And indeed, last week when it paraded the Hwasong-17, it said that it was the very missile that it had fired in its most recent ICBM test. So also, we have to watch for their nuclear test. They have been renovating and repairing their Punggye-ri nuclear weapons test site. And experts say they are ready at any moment, at any time now, to fire off a nuclear warhead. There are signs that they have now miniaturized that nuclear warhead. And that will pose a real threat because then they can mount this on the Hwasong-17 and shoot it anywhere at the U.S. mainland. So never before has the North's position at the negotiating table with the U.S. been stronger than it is now. And it held its most largest and most impressive parade recently last week, showcasing not just the Hwasong-17, but the Hwasong-8 hypersonic glide vehicle, which can also carry nuclear warheads that have been miniaturized. And of course, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at that parade vowed publicly in a speech to speed up his country's development of nuclear weapons and nuclear missile delivery systems as soon as possible to counter threats of a preemptive attack from the U.S., not just as a deterrent, but also to use them preemptively in case its national interests are threatened. So the North is becoming more and more bold in its declaration of its use of nuclear weapons, and the U.S. and its allies are getting more and more helpless in the face of the North's development of nuclear weapons and its willingness to use nuclear weapons preemptively.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Jennifer Chang. Now that brings us to the end of this edition of World News On.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the Manhattan District Attorney is continuing to investigate former President Donald J. Trump, but knowledgeable people say charges are unlikely to occur in the foreseeable future, if ever. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Ben Protest, Jonah Bromwich, William Rashbaum, and Lana Nguyen. The piece is titled "Likelihood of Trump Indictment in Manhattan Fades as Grand Jury Wraps Up." When some two dozen New Yorkers filed into a Manhattan courthouse this week to finish out their grand jury service, the case against a man who would have been the world's most prominent criminal defendant was no longer before them. That man, Donald Trump, was facing potential criminal charges from the grand jury this year over his business practices. But in the weeks since the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, stopped presenting evidence to the jurors about Donald Trump, new signs have emerged that the former president will not be indicted in Manhattan in the foreseeable future, if at all. At least three of the witnesses, once central to the case, have either not heard from the district attorney's office in months or have not been asked to testify, according to people with knowledge of the matter. In recent weeks, a prosecutor at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, who played a key role in the investigation, has stopped focusing on a potential case against Donald Trump. Other people with knowledge of the inquiry have said. A move that followed the resignation earlier this year of two senior prosecutors leading the investigation. And the remaining prosecutors working on the Donald Trump investigation have abandoned the war room they used to prepare for their grand jury presentation early this year, the people said, leaving behind an expansive office suit and conference room on the 15th floor of the district attorney's office in Lower Manhattan. The grand jury's expiration at the end of the month does not preclude prosecutors from impaneling another jury. But the developments underscore the reduced possibility that Donald Trump will face charges under Alvin Bragg, who, along with several other prosecutors, had concerns about proving the case. Some people close to the inquiry believe that it will not result in an indictment for the former president unless a witness cooperates unexpectedly, a long shot in an investigation that has been running for more than 3 years. In recent weeks, Alvin Bragg's prosecutors have issued a few additional subpoenas that indicate they are continuing to investigate but have not found a new path to charging Donald Trump. The previous unreported subpoenas, people with knowledge of the matter have said, appear to focus on the same topic that has long been the subject of the investigation: whether Donald Trump falsely inflated the value of his assets in annual financial statements. The subpoena suggests that, rather than pursuing a new theory of the case, Alvin Bragg is looking at additional entities that received Mr. Trump's financial statements as he sought loans and pursued other business, and that the prosecutors are seeking potential victims of the former president. One of the subpoenas went to a major financial institution that may have received Donald Trump's financial statements. A second subpoena, sent to the Trump Organization, largely followed up on an earlier demand to the company for records related to the value of its properties. And a third subpoena went to the New York City agency that tracks municipal vendors, including Donald Trump, who has done business with the city for years, operating a golf course in the Bronx and an ice rink in Central Park. In an interview this month, Alvin Bragg said that his prosecutors were interviewing new witnesses and looking at additional evidence. He declined to provide any details, citing grand jury secrecy law, but said that the inquiry must be allowed to run its course. "It's a work in progress," Alvin Bragg said, adding later, "We've got seasoned prosecutors working every day. It's not going to be on a timeline." But impaneling a new grand jury could create challenges for any potential case. Donald Trump's lawyers could argue, and a judge might agree, that prosecutors were inappropriately hunting for a more favorable group of jurors. It would also take time to prepare a new presentation of evidence and months to lay out a case to jurors. Alvin Bragg's office does not have unlimited time to charge Donald Trump. Witnesses could forget key information. Prosecutors would also face a deadline to file the charges within 5 years of any crimes being committed, though there are some exceptions that extend that deadline. And were Donald Trump to announce another presidential run, Alvin Bragg would be likely to face political pressure not to indict a leading contender for the White House. But even as the criminal investigation fades from public view, the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, appears poised to take action against Donald Trump as part of her inquiry into whether he falsely inflated the value of his assets in annual financial statements. The same conduct at the centre of the criminal investigation. At a court hearing on Monday, 25th of April, a lawyer from her office said that the Attorney General, Letitia James, would probably take action against the former president in the near future. Because her investigation is civil, Letitia James can bring a lawsuit, but not criminal charges. At that hearing, a judge held Donald Trump in contempt of court for failing to fully comply with a subpoena for records from Letitia James. And on Friday, despite Donald Trump's lawyers having filed documents that they said brought him into compliance with the subpoena, the judge declined to withdraw the contempt order, which is costing Donald Trump $10,000 a day. Mr. Trump has long denied wrongdoing and accused Letitia James and Alvin Bragg, both of whom are black and Democrats, of being politically motivated racists. If he ultimately is sued or indicted, his lawyers would be likely to point towards the disclaimer that his financial statements were not audited by his accountants and that they were submitted to sophisticated financial institutions that conducted their own due diligence. Alvin Bragg's office is monitoring Letitia James's civil investigation for potential new leads, he has said. And Ms. James's office is participating in the district attorney's criminal investigation opened by Alvin Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus R. Vance Jr., more than 3 years ago. In December, Cyrus Vance directed the two senior prosecutors leading the criminal inquiry, Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, to present evidence to a grand jury with the goal of seeking an indictment of Donald Trump. But when Alvin Bragg took office this year, he and several of his aides raised concerns about the strength of the case, questioning whether they could prove that Donald Trump intended to break the law. Other prosecutors in the office had raised similar concerns, people with knowledge of the matter have said. In the final months of Cyrus Vance's tenure, three assistant district attorneys stopped working on the investigation, concerned about how rapidly it was proceeding and what they felt were gaps in the evidence against the former president. Alvin Bragg eventually decided to halt the grand jury presentation, prompting the departure of Kerry Dunn and of Mark Pomerantz, who stated in his resignation letter that he believed that Donald Trump was guilty of numerous felonies. Just weeks after their departure, Solomon Shinarok, one of the key prosecutors on the team, stopped investigating Donald Trump. Mr. Shinarok, who for years was the lead assistant district attorney in the investigation, pulled back in part because it appeared to be winding down, two of the people familiar with the inquiry have said. The Daily Beast first reported that Mr. Shinarok was no longer actively involved in the investigation. While Mr. Shinarok is not investigating Donald Trump, he's still working on a Trump-related case. In July, Manhattan prosecutors indicted the Trump Organization and its longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, accusing him of a years-long tax evasion scheme. Mr. Shinarok is playing a central role in preparing for that trial, and given that role, is participating in meetings where the investigation into Donald Trump is discussed, a person with knowledge of the meetings have said. In the interview this month, Alvin Bragg said that no one had left the Trump team since Kerry Dunn and Mark Pomerantz. Asked this week to clarify his remarks, Alvin Bragg's spokeswoman stood by them, saying that there was one dedicated team working on the indicated tax case and the Trump investigation. The team is led by Susan Hoffinger, an experienced prosecutor from Alvin Bragg, appointed to lead the officer's investigations division. The spokeswoman, Danielle Filson, said in a statement that the team included lawyers who have worked on the case for years and skilled new prosecutors with decades of experience and fresh eyes. She declined to say how many prosecutors and other staff are assigned to the team investigating Donald Trump, but said it was actively probing unexplored avenues. In the early days of Alvin Bragg's tenure, the core members of the Trump team took over a 15th floor conference room as they pushed ahead with the presentation of evidence about the former president to a grand jury. But since the resignations of Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, the team has abandoned that room. An indication, veterans of the office say that the case is not headed towards a grand jury anytime soon. The team members are now sitting in offices in the Major Economic Crimes Bureau.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Rules of Engagement, Part 2.
Berlin, Germany. From here, we are going to start looking at the occupation of Palestine. This is an unusual look through the eyes of Israeli soldiers that broke their silence. They will tell about the crimes they committed on behalf of the Zionist regime.
Now 4 million people were in control of the Palestinian society, and we as soldiers that were sent to the army in Israel at the age of 18, 19, you go to the army, it's a mandatory service. About 5-6 months I served in Hebron, the second largest Palestinian city in the West Bank. 800 settlers that live inside of a Palestinian city. For those 800 people, there are about 500-600 security forces to protect them. This exhibition, about 60 pictures all taken by soldiers, and they took those pictures during their military service for a memory for themselves. When your mission is to a curfew or detain people and you succeed in this mission, you wanna document. This is like a trophy for you. It's a sick trophy, and these guys, no doubt, lost every kind of limit there is. And if that's not enough, you see this soldier here, the officer, he wanted the trophy only for himself. So he wanted to do a Photoshop picture. This is not a genuine picture. This is not real. It's copied here. I did occupation. I controlled people's lives. I decided if someone can or cannot go to school today. This picture is a good example. The soldier randomly checking a Palestinian in the street. The middle of the day, he hasn't done anything, he's not suspected, he checks him. This was probably the most regular view in Hebron for us. Detained Palestinians. Hundreds of them. So what does it mean to detain a person? See the soldiers on the back? This was a good time to relax, to have a break, smoke a cigarette, talk with your friend, watch TV, have a lunch maybe. Without noticing again, these people that you detain, start looking at them as people. They are just detained Palestinians. Blindfolded, always. We see here are confiscated keys, Palestinian keys. We control not only people's cars, we control people's keys, homes and shops and apartments, whatever you can imagine. You can come a bit closer, I want to show you this picture. If you would look carefully, Palestinian kids play soldiers. See, they're checking each other. These are supposed to be the guns. And in a way, I'm saying it in a very sad way, because these children imitate their life. This is not their imagination, it's what they saw. That they are doing this is because they live under occupation.
To know more about this movement that is rising among the Israeli soldiers, we traveled to Israel. Here we are going to meet former soldiers and officers that helped to keep the occupant of Palestine alive. From Tel Aviv, we take the road. Our destination, Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, Palestine. This route, like 80% of the total highway system in the West Bank, is forbidden to Palestinians. Built on private Palestinian land, these highways bisect through villages, dividing families and boxing Palestinians into enclaves. We want to reach the Al-Khalil city centre. After exposing the Israeli army crimes, Nadav, a former infantry combat soldier, is going to meet us here, in the ground zero of the occupation.
My name is Nadav Diegelman. I'm originally from Jerusalem. I served in the IDF, in the 5th Battalion of the Nahal Brigade as an infantry. And I reached here for the first time when I was wearing a uniform and holding a gun when I was in the army. And I was shocked. I was shocked that a reality like this can happen 40 minutes from my house. The settlers here are an issue. Yeah, we're talking about 850 settlers. They're being protected by around 500 to 600 security forces in any given day. So around the settlements, there are areas that Palestinians cannot move to secure the settlers. And there's a lot of violence that comes from the settlers.
Welcome to Al-Khalil. Al-Khalil is the ground zero for the illegal Israeli settler movement, radical Zionism and violence. Radical settlers have taken over parts of Old City. Palestinian neighborhoods and the economy were destroyed. Settlers are free to kill and terrorize Palestinians. Oh. 850 Zionist settlers set down in the Al-Khalil city center. Palestinians were expelled. They now live surrounded by a fence or a cage from where they cannot move. If you want to know what occupation really means, you should come to Al-Khalil. We are a potential target for the Jewish settlers' hate. We have a camera, and our guide is a former soldier that has broken his silence. Traitor, according to the settlers.
This is a picture that was taken in the late 90s in this street that we are on now, and I think this tells the whole story, how hundreds and thousands of people, Palestinians, left here. We're talking about 42% of the housing units of Palestinians around the settlement were abandoned. 1,800 shops of Palestinians were shut down. The shops we see here next to us, part of them. Hundreds were shut down by the army. Hundreds were shut down by the Palestinians.
Al-Khalil is divided into two parts. H1 and H2, drawing a line between the settlements and the rest of the city. Palestinians are not allowed anywhere near H2. Shuhada, the main Al-Khalil street, was once a bustling market and residential neighbourhood. Today, Shuhada is a ghost area. Only settlers can cross it. Palestinians are forbidden to approach Shuhada.
This is an important place because, first of all, this used to go back and forth to the markets, the other side. We came from over there, it's basically all shut down. There is nothing, everything is shut down. Most of the families left, except one family. That family was able, up until a few years ago, to walk through here as well. Now that it's sealed, they also need to go all the way from around. Another gate here that the soldiers needs to open. But this is just one, you know, very small example of how shutting down of roads to Palestinian movement.
August 2016. Israeli soldiers are entering Palestinian houses in Al-Khalil. An activist follows them with a camera.
Can you tell me why you're entering Palestinian houses?
We are doing our job.
Okay, what job? What exactly are you trying to achieve? Because these are people, they live here, right? It's not your homes.
This time, the Israeli army steps back. Soldiers don't want witnesses. Reach Al-Khalil's main square, a forbidden territory for the Palestinians. What we're about to see is part of the occupation daily routine. A 15-year-old Palestinian girl is arrested in a checkpoint. She is taken inside a police station and disappears for some time. She is accused of trying to stab a soldier. When she is taken outside, her hands are tied and she is heavily guarded by soldiers and police. She is left under the sun for hours, and this is what happens next. For this Palestinian teenager, this is just the beginning of a long nightmare. An Israeli police officer takes photos of the girl in the middle of the street, in front of everybody. Finally, she is taken away. She will be taken to a military base, will face a military court, and will end in a military jail. To learn more about the future of this Palestinian teenager, we should travel to Jerusalem Al-Quds. We're going to meet Gerard Horton, a lawyer and co-founder of Military Court Watch.
It's an organisation of mostly lawyers, Palestinian, Israeli, English, Australian, American lawyers, focusing on the prosecution of children in Israeli military courts. Under the laws of war, if you're going to try civilians in a situation of occupation, it is a military court that does it. That situation is supposed to be temporary. And we're now approaching the 50th anniversary of the occupation. No one envisaged that a situation of occupation would go on for that length of time. Approximately 800 to 1,000 children are detained each year. The most common offence they're prosecuted for is throwing stones. At least half of the children are detained in the middle of the night. The moment you hear the knock on the door, banging on the front door, from that moment on, it's a fairly terrifying experience for the next 12 to 24 hours. You might wake up to an explosion. Get out of bed, you find armed, heavily armed soldiers in your house. If you have younger siblings, they will be crying and terrified, seeing all these soldiers. Sometimes there are dogs with the soldiers as well. The parents generally will be arguing with the commander, trying to get information. Why are you in my house? Why are you arresting my son? Have his hands tied with plastic ties, frequently very tightly. The more you struggle, the tighter they get, so they become very painful. You'll be blindfolded. Your parents will not be told where you're being taken to or why you're being arrested. The children report they put on the metal floor of the military vehicle. The soldiers will sit on the seats and the Palestinian detainees will be on the metal floor. Only the soldiers will put their boots, their feet on the individuals, kicking, punching. In the middle of the night, taken out, left outside on the floor, tied and blindfolded, or put in a shipping container. If they try to sleep, they're slapped to keep them awake, so they're sleep deprived by the time they get to the interrogation center. Sometimes when they ask to use the toilet, they're not allowed to use the toilet. At 2 o'clock in the morning or so, they'll be put back in the military vehicle, taken to an interrogation center. Usually they won't have slept. They may have been slapped around a little bit, nothing to eat or drink generally. Psychologically, they'll be in a very scared condition. The interrogator will start conducting the interrogation in a fairly intimidatory manner. Often will approach the child. The interrogators are often quite physically large individuals, particularly compared to the child. In many cases, the child will remain tied during the interrogation, so obviously it's a very intimidating position to be in. The interrogators frequently then will shout at the child, threaten the child, threaten the child's family. Almost in every case, the interrogator will tell the child that the other children we arrested with you, they've all confessed, and we've sent them home, so it's pointless you resisting any further. So after half an hour, most children will provide a confession. The overwhelming majority of children do not get to consult with a lawyer prior to their interrogation, and they're not informed of their right to silence. Interrogate the child in Arabic and document it in Hebrew. Then the Hebrew statement is given to the child to sign. It may be accurate, it may not be. There's no way for that child to tell. Whether the child says he's innocent or not, generally the lawyer will advise the child to plead guilty, even if he says he's innocent. If the child wants to maintain his innocence and challenge the evidence, in most cases the court will deny the child bail, which means he will sit in prison waiting for the case to come on for hearing. So the quickest way to get out of this system, even if you're innocent, is to simply plead guilty. In addition to that, your parents will be fined. The fining serves a very useful process. If the army is faced with a village that is throwing a lot of stones...
Every time somebody throwing rocks, we see this kid. We remember his face. If I see his face again, I don't care if I see him throw rocks or not, he's going to go with us.
I am asking this.
Listen to me. He's going to go with me, and he's going to be tied up all night, and he's going to get punished, and you're going to need a pay to take him back.
Then the army will keep going into that village, rounding people up. Some of them will have thrown stones. Some of the people they round up won't have thrown stones. It doesn't matter. You round people up, you put them through the military court, you fine the parents, and you bankrupt the village until they stop resisting.
Someone attacked some settlers, I mean, to justify all these.
Not a single settler was killed in the West Bank in 2012. I think it's a real mark of the success of the military strategy that in 2012, out of 400,000 Israeli civilians living, going shopping, taking their children to school, whatever normal people do in their daily lives, none of them were killed living in occupied territory. And I think America tried to do something similar in Afghanistan, moved 400,000 American civilians into Kandahar province and told them to build towns and villages. I think the casualty would be very high.
From Jerusalem, Al-Quds, we take the way to Beit Fajar. The town rests on a hilltop overlooking a large area of the West Bank that stretches from Al-Khalil to Bethlehem. Surrounded by five illegal Jewish settlements, the daily life in Beit Fajar is a nightmare of arrests, kidnappings and night raids. Arrests and detainments have become a powerful mechanism that the Zionist regime uses to force the population into submission. At the age of 14, Issam has already experienced interrogations and a military court. Al-Khalil is one of the most demanding places for a soldier to be posted to. Young Israelis, some still teenagers, are in the front line of the occupation. We are about to learn that, in the near future, things can only get worse.
Hey? Don't touch me! Don't touch me! Don't touch me!
These kids are the future generation of Jewish settlers in Palestinian land. Harassed by the young settlers, we decided to move away. But they came with a mission and would not give up. They would do anything to stop us. They were sent by the older settlers to do their job.
Don't even think to touch me.
Don't touch me.
The soldiers have clear orders from their commanders. They cannot touch the settlers, no matter what they do. The young settlers will follow us to make sure we leave Al-Khalil without telling the story. The soldiers are afraid of them and of the reaction of the settlers' community in Al-Khalil, who are heavily armed and live above and beyond the law. The young settler says Nadav is a traitor and tries to attack him.
Hey, don't touch me.
I'm not touching you.
No, come
on. Don't touch
me.
I'm putting my hand here. You don't touch me.
Come on.
We have to leave Al-Khalil for security reasons.
In the limelight.
James Dyke, Assistant Director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, Southwest England, said it's hard to believe that Elsevier, a Dutch company that publishes research about the dangers of the climate and ecological crises, is the very same company that actively works with oil and gas companies to extract more fossil fuels, which drags us towards disaster. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Amy Westworld, titled "Revealed: Leading Climate Research Publisher Helps Fuel Oil and Gas Drilling." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. The Guardian can reveal scientists working with one of the world's largest climate research publishers say
They're increasingly alarmed that the company works with the fossil fuel industry to help increase oil and gas drilling. Elsevier, a Dutch company behind many renowned peer-reviewed scientific journals, including The Lancet and Global Environmental Change, is also one of the top publishers of books aimed at expanding fossil fuel production. For more than a decade, the company has supported the energy industry's efforts to optimize oil and gas extraction. It commissions authors, editors, and journal advisory board members who are employees at top oil firms. Elsevier also markets some of its research portals and data services directly to the oil and gas industry to help increase the odds of exploration success. Several former and current employees say that for the past year, dozens of workers have spoken out internally and at company-wide town halls to urge Elsevier to reconsider its relationship with the fossil fuel industry. A former Elsevier journal editor who agreed to speak on condition of anonymity said, "When I first started, I heard a lot about the company's climate commitments," adding, "Eventually, I just realized it was all marketing, which is really upsetting because Elsevier has published all the research it needs to know exactly what to do if it wants to make a meaningful difference." What makes Elsevier ties to the fossil fuel industry particularly alarming to its critics is that it is one of the handful of companies that publish peer-reviewed climate research. Scientists and academics say they are concerned that Elsevier's conflicting business interests risk undermining their work.